Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. You're with Tangential Banter. I'm your host, Ben Mowell. I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korsnowski.
Ahoy there, y'all.
That's a pretty sweet greeting, actually.
Ahoy there, y'all?
Yeah, I was just thinking about it. You're like combining piratey language with Southern language.
Maritime and Southerners. I guess that makes sense. There's a lot of ocean to the south. You got the Gulf and then the ocean, you know, and it loops around on the side. So and then there's Florida, which is a lot of coastline per square mile of state size.
I suppose a lot of the Caribbean pirates probably landed on the southern coast at some point in time, or maybe came from the south. Could be. Who can know such things? Well, I've got somewhat of a off-the-wall topic to start us off today, and we'll see where it goes.
What is it, Ben?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So what I've been pondering, or this thought that popped into my head today as I was thinking about topics for the session, is, you know, here on Earth, humans, particularly in the U.S., have this fascination with having lawns around our homes. And I guess sometimes in the Southwest, you know, they're kind of trying to go more for a type of aesthetic that matches more with the local biome.
Like gravel and rock and stuff. Not so much grass.
Yeah, and like succulents or cacti or whatever, you know.
Yep.
But I was thinking, as it appears, lunar and Martian exploration and colonies are inevitable, what will we replace those things with when we have colonies? So instead of lawns, what will we have on the moon and on Mars?
So since this was your topic, have you been thinking on that? And and do you have some speculation that will one day, probably 70 years or so from now, be horribly disproven, just like mine will be? Because we know how good we are at predicting the future. If you ever see those magazine covers from like 1920, or say, like, you know, what the year 2000 will look like, and it's like, wow, you were way off.
It's weird. Some of those couldn't be farther from the truth, and some of them are wildly or weirdly accurate. You know, it just kind of depends on who it was, and or there's elements of it that are really off and elements of it that are spot on. Like I saw a meme the other day that was, it was just noting how like accurately the Jetsons, yeah, predicted the future with some of their stuff that was in the show.
Oh, I was never a fan, or I never really watched the Jetsons. It was never on any of the stations I had as a kid. Alas.
Yeah, I didn't either. So I was going based off of just the meme itself.
Let's stop the recording. Let's go watch the entirety of the Jetsons and then come back with a full report for our listeners.
Wow. That would be an undertaking.
Would it? Let's see. Hold on.
I don't know. I don't know how much.
The Jetsons. Let me look it up. Jetsons. Let's see. Number of seasons, 3. Number of episodes, 75.
Woo.
So not that much.
75 episodes at what? 20 minutes, 25 a pop?
Yeah.
A desk pop?
You never done a desktop before? Or a desktop? Wow. Just move on to the next joke. I give up.
So going back to your question, that thought of what replaces lawn, or what would replace lawns as we expand throughout the solar system, turned into some other questions, but I guess I'll take a stab at it first. I think it depends primarily on what form our habitation takes. So if we, which I think is unlikely, were to build individual domiciles similar to what we do on Earth, where each family or whatever type of cluster there is has their own residence. I think it would be most likely that it's just going to be some sort of a rock collection. It would look like the Southwest more, where maybe you have some, you do something visually with different colors of rocks or layouts or textures or whatever, but there probably wouldn't be plant life, just at least in the early stages, because the atmosphere can't sustain it.
Are you assuming that there'll be like the domiciles will just be out in the lunar quote unquote atmosphere, or will they be under some sort of biodome?
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting at, is that in this first scenario, which I think is unlikely, like each residence would be a standalone unit that's exposed to the current surface conditions on the moon or on Mars. I think the other possibility, which in my mind is far more likely, is that there would be some sort of large city level containment or atmospheric containment system, like a some sort of a biosphere, biodome, whatever, with smaller buildings within that. In which case, I think it entirely plausible that there would be, it'd be kind of like, have you ever been to like a, what are they called? It's a garden, type of garden.
Arboretum?
Yeah, like an arboretum, but there's a botanical garden. That's the word I was looking for.
Oh, is that when it's like in a big glass enclosure, usually?
Yeah, usually. So I feel like that's probably what it would end up looking like to some extent. You'd have essentially like a botanical garden, only there would be other buildings inside of it, or maybe rooms, I guess you could call them. For the individuals or families or whatever to reside within that. Because I think, I mean, the plants would obviously help with the air quality and quality of life, and serve, yeah, just as decoration and stuff. And they would work inside of a botanical garden that they wouldn't work, you know, just being out exposed to the surface conditions. Well, that's my working theory right now. It's not very exciting, but that's what I've got.
So the question, so my theory was it would be more of a kind of like what we see in the Southwest, if there were lawns and all, where there'd be more or less just open spaces, maybe with some decoration, but not any plant life. It would all just be rocks, boulders, or statuette sorts of things. That's assuming that there's individual domiciles outside. If you're in a dome, then you have more options. I still don't think plant life like grass or flowers or bushes, things like that, would be plausible, because all of the plant life on Earth is designed for a 24-hour, you know, day cycle, whereas on the moon it would be a month-long day cycle. So they would have they'd have sunlight for what, like, you know, 15-ish days or 14 days straight, and then no sun for 28 days straight, or 14 days straight. And that I'm guessing that would kill off a lot of the plant life. Now on Mars, it might be a different story, because I think Mars has a comparable day length as Earth. Actually, you know what? I got the computer right in front of me. Let's look it up. Mars, but, hold on, revolution. Wow, that word is not in the Wikipedia page. Day? Come on, it's got to have it on here. Days and seasons on Mars. There's a Wikipedia page devoted to that. Oh, here it is. Oh, the average length of a Martian sidereal day is 24 hours, 37 minutes. And the length of its solar day is 24 hours, 39 minutes. Interesting. So it's just about a half hour longer than Earth. Huh.
So I think, I mean, your premise is dependent on using natural light sources for your plant growth, right?
Well, if they're exposed, well, I guess on Mars it's possible if we oxygenated the atmosphere, because I don't think it has enough oxygen in it to sustain the life that we would bring from Earth. But let's say we did, then we wouldn't need any artificial lighting system. Now, the light on Mars would be weaker, but probably not to such a degree where life or that plants couldn't survive there. I mean, we would basically just have to take plants that grow, you know, in the northern parts of the northern or far southern parts of the planet on Earth, and they would do just fine on Mars if they may not even detect a difference if they're more near the equator to kind of make up for the further distance and the weaker sun.
You're still talking about outdoor plants.
Right. So no, it would still apply to the bio if you're in a biodome, but if they're reliant on just normal sunlight as well. So if you have a biodome with a fully enclosed roof and there's a lighting system to sort of mimic Earth's lighting system, or, you know, the Earth day, then obviously this isn't as much of a factor. But if it's a giant, like, let's say, glass top dome where you have sunlight or you don't, then particularly on the moon, we're going to run into a problem based on the day cycles are going to be way out of whack.
Yeah, I think even with glass, you could still have grow lamps and stuff to account for times when there's less daylight or whatever. Maybe the harder thing to do, I guess you could have to account for the too much light, you could always have shades that would block some of it if you needed to. But I think if it was in a indoor environment, you could control enough of the variables that you could grow pretty much whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
I don't think that would be a problem.
Now, well, that would still require some sort of system. Maybe, I don't know if it'd be on the dome level or if it'd be on a lawn for lawn level of supplying light when it is nighttime, or shading from extra sunlight when you're trying to produce nighttime. So that'd be an interesting little nuance. But another thing I wanted to bring up too in this discussion as a whole is the question, what is the purpose of a lawn? Would these lunar or Martian colonies even have lawns in the first place? Because we see examples on Earth, like apartments or building complexes, where it's like a skyscraper or a multi-story building, and people just rent kind of, you know, sections of that building, or in the sense of condos, actually buy and purchase sections of that building. So they have a living space, but they have no yard. So if we were to build colonies, what would justify us using the resources to develop lawns? Because, for example, if you have a bunch of houses that do have lawns, your biodome all of a sudden needs to be a lot bigger to accommodate them.
Mm-hmm.
So sure. would they say, yes, let's spend the resources to build a bigger biodome so that we can have lawns? Like, what would their motivation be for that? What's the purpose of a lawn? Like, if we had to really ask ourselves, right now on Earth, we have the real estate. We don't have to do anything to develop a lawn. The land is just sitting right there. But if we have, if we go to Mars or we go to the moon and say, we want to put this land to some use for an individual family or an individual domicile owner, you know, what would that use be? What's the purpose of giving one person that much space?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. A couple thoughts that come to mind. So I've actually done a little bit of reading on this in the past, because I think when I see the amount of effort that some people put into like creating and maintaining the perfectly manicured lawn, it annoys me how much time they spend on it and how much energy and effort and resources go into it.
Yep.
So it's like, I've asked that question before, of what is the purpose of the lawn? And I think if you go back far enough, its origins essentially came from as people were building a cabin or some kind of a shelter, right? They were clearing trees from the area to build it. And as we cleared, part of that became the more space you had around your home, the less there were creepy crawlies and rodents and all sorts of little things that you didn't want in your home that were actually trying to come in, right? Because their habitat was farther removed from your home. So the little grassland around a shelter became a buffer between a lot of the sorts of things that you didn't want in your house and the things that are in a forest or whatever.
Oh yeah, because they'd have to like make a break for it, right? Through the
big
open area between the forest and your house, and then they could get snatched by birds of prey or whatnot.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's so why we cut our lawns now, is I think to discourage that stuff. It's not like that reason's gone away.
Well, I think for most people, they don't make any conscious connection between a lawn and rodents or anything. It's, I have a lawn, and our custom or our socially accepted behavior is to keep it short. And I'm, you know, or my HOA has rules that it has to be cut so often or kept below a certain length. And so we just kind of do it, not really thinking of its original connection to pest control, but more as an appearance, aesthetic. And now it's like having a well-kept lawn, or one that's in at least decent shape, it's an activity space, right? You can walk on it. You can play yard games. Kids can run around, whatever. You can sunbathe, whatever you want to do, right? But it kind of becomes a way to enjoy, even if it's a small slice of nature, you still get to enjoy something green and growing, and kind of have that connection to the land a little bit.
Yeah. But I would still say, if you did let your lawn go completely and it did just grow up to become prairie land effectively, you probably would notice a lot more creepy crawlies.
Yes. You would probably learn why people mow their lawn.
That actually brings up that's a good factor in this discussion, right? Because there is no wildlife, at least, you know, yet on the moon and on Mars, we wouldn't need, and there's no vegetation to even cut down in the first place. Would we even need the lawn? Because it sounds like the origins of the lawn, unless you had houses that were right next to each other, you intentionally spread out that area between your house and the edge of the wilderness to keep the animals away. So if there's no animals to keep away, do you need a lawn in the first place? Now, let me rephrase that. The lawn probably would not have developed if we somehow grew up as the sole living species on a planet.
Right.
And didn't have to go to crawlies. But what about how we, because that's not the people who are going to go colonize Mars and the moon. It's going to be people who are used to having lawns today and in the near future. So would they advocate for having lawns for what they use it for?
It may and may not be, right? Because we already live in the within the last few years, the first time in history where the majority of Earth's population lives in cities rather than in rural areas, right? So there is a growing percentage of humanity that live in a world that's very gray and doesn't have green and brown things in it at a significant level, especially the bigger and bigger the city gets. So there's a couple, from a utilitarian perspective, I would say no, the useful, rodent avoidance of element of a lawn probably doesn't exist on Mars or on the moon. But I think it still does serve a quality of life and aesthetic function that maybe is underrated. Because I think if you were to go to the moon or Mars and just be completely, your experience there was completely devoid of any kind of growing things, I feel like that would be super sterile, boring. I suspect the long-term mental health effects would not be good. And going back to the whole biodome thing, I think if your goal was to fit as many people into as small of a volume as cheaply as possible in this colony, I think you would basically build a lunar or Martian hotel, and then you would just make it so the windows don't open and you'd have an airlock to come in and out. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't even have open air spaces, like a common open air space in that sense, because what do you need the open air for unless you have things that are growing? And so I think you, if you had the biodome thing, what would be more likely is that the actual living space might be dug into the surface crust itself, down into the soil. And then what's under the biodome would be like a park that's available for all residents to, you know, use at their leisure. So their residents might not have it individually, but then they would have access to a green space for the collective community there.
Your point about the, like the hotel, so basically, or like a condo or a like an apartment complex where it's a standalone building, not under a biodome, that would probably make the most sense. Cause I would imagine a biodome would be, you know, I don't think we've ever done anything like that. I think it's all been sci-fi where that idea has come from. And I would guess in reality, that would be very impractical to do. Maybe not. So what probably would be the norm is a series of buildings that are all airlocked, and then there's probably, and then walkways like a skyway going between them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yep. I grew up in the Twin Cities, and I would guess Chicago has this, but I can't confirm. Like in downtown, there's a bunch of so like little tunnels connecting the big buildings to one another just above street level. They'd probably
above or below.
Above the street, so they're not underground. So I say tunnels because it's the
least they're connected. Elevated walkways.
Yeah. So like you drive under them, and you know there's windows and stuff people can look out of, and it's really convenient. You know, they built them, I would presume, as a combination of reducing foot traffic outside and because of the winter.
Yeah, you're saying foot traffic crossing the street, right?
Right. Get fewer people, or get more people off the street to reduce foot traffic and, you know, danger to pedestrians. And it's all inside, climate controlled. So when winter comes, you don't have to go outside very often. You can go, you can walk inside pretty extensively throughout the city.
I believe that phenomena is actually fairly somewhat unique to the cities. I haven't seen that in Chicago, and I've definitely heard, like, I've heard of that being true of Minneapolis before, but it was like a unique feature about that city that they had this downtown network of connections.
I want to say Duluth, Minnesota has something like that too, but that's a much smaller city.
But it's primarily a function of the environment, right? The climate there it's somewhat necessary in the wintertime.
Right. So, I mean, we already have a system like that where you're wholly inside, and you can, I'm sure some of those skyways go to apartment buildings. So you could live in the city and just walk through buildings and walk through these skyways your whole day and never step a foot outside. Now, I don't know if that's how they're actually designed. I don't know if all your daily needs are actually all interconnected with the skyway, but the potential is certainly there. And I think if you're doing like a lunar or a Martian colony, that would be the most practical way of doing it, because you don't have a big biodome and you have all these airlocked buildings. So that would probably be the most efficient way to do a building. But then the problem is, if they're all disjointed and there isn't a skyway, you'd have to like get prepped to go on a spacewalk every time you wanted to leave your building.
Right. Yeah. But so I think if you went down that path, then the question also becomes, why not build below the surface, right? Because part of the reason we build above the surface here is because the atmosphere is agreeable with our biology, right? So you can open a window to adjust the temperature, to get fresh air or whatever. You can walk outside without needing a spacesuit. If those aren't viable options, then there's not really value in building on the surface. You're not going to get, I mean, I guess sunlight would be one, but you could use like sun, what's the word I'm looking for? The windows.
Skylights?
Skylights. Yeah, you could use skylights. Thank you. You could use skylights for underground dwellings. And then you'd have, instead of having to develop materials, building materials on Mars, you're essentially just removing material and then sealing a space to be effective as a. So I feel like it'd be a lot cheaper, more sustainable in that environment to just go below ground.
That's a good point, because I was thinking, well, I would speculate the reason why we don't do a lot of digging underground is because it's so difficult to get, to dig a mine or to actually carve out all of that material without digging a giant pit that you would now have to, well, and now how do we put a ceiling on this thing? But you're right in that, well, if we colonize these places, they may not have the natural resources for building materials. They don't have any wood.
Right.
For one. So we'd have to use all metal or plastics or fiberglass, material like that. And I don't know, but maybe Mars and the moon just don't have easily accessible resources where we can just mine and refine our own metals or other materials there. So we'd have to bring it from Earth.
Right. Which makes it expensive.
Very stupid expensive until maybe they develop nuclear powered rockets, which I actually think I heard of one recently in the news they're going to try out, which makes the most sense to me. I don't know why it took them this long to develop one.
So now imagine that they build giant, maybe they're even underground biodomes so that they can cultivate trees to make building materials cheaper on Mars.
Ooh.
Like 100 years down the road.
Nice.
Although, again, like wood's not super valuable as a building material if you can't, because houses built that way are so hard to seal, right? You'd have to perpetually pump your house full of some oxygen supply somewhere because you'd be leaking to the environment. So, it doesn't seem that feasible.
The wood doesn't necessarily have to be the skin, if you will, of the building. It can just be the support structure.
Yeah, I just mean like trying to get, if you build a house today out of 2x4s on Earth, it's extremely hard to make it airtight and to restrict the amount of airflow in and out. And that's partially due to the construction materials. Even with Tyvek and, non-wood sealants that we're wrapping it up with. But
sure.
So the other thought, this reminded me of a idea I had, I don't know, probably before high school, something I wanted to do. If I ever had the money, I wanted to develop a three-layered city. And the idea was it would be somewhere in the Great Lakes, probably Lake Michigan, for the reason that there aren't really significant natural disasters. So we don't have tornadoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, any of that kind of stuff. But so below the lake level, so like on the lake bed, there would be a city built in a dome underwater. And then in the middle of that city, there would be an elevator going up to the surface, and where there would be a city built on, kind of like Mexico City used to be before the Spaniards arrived, when it was these floating mats, essentially. So you have a city built on the lake surface that floats like a houseboat kind of configuration. And then there'd be an elevator from there going up to, obviously it would have to be scaled down, but some sort of a city built hanging from like permanent dirigibles that are anchored to the lake bed. So it'd be like three distinct cities, but that are all located or stacked on top of each other, right?
Yeah.
With an elevator connecting the lake bed to the surface to the sky city thing. And then you could have roads on the lake bed connecting to a couple points of the nearest shoreline. You could be also arrive by boat on the surface, or you could take a helicopter or plane or something or a balloon, I guess, to the floating part.
Did you have like a practical application for this, or is this just like, oh, this would be so cool sort of thing?
No, I just thought it would be sweet. And it'd be like a private city where you could like sell residences for people to live there and, screen out whoever you don't want. So no real practical application. I just thought it'd be cool. Because it's like, imagine living, you live in the city under the water, and then you get bored and you're like, eh, I'll go see what it's like, you know, 500 feet above the surface or whatever.
Right.
So you take the elevator out and you go watch some birds from the flight deck, you know, and then you go back down. But I was also thinking about that. The elevator shaft could also contain, you know, massive air handling units to get air down to the city below, and water pipes to get water up to the city above, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. How they'd have to pump water all the way up there.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
That's pretty neat.
That's pretty neat. Yeah, the water pressure to supply a city hundreds of feet above lake level would be substantial.
It's a lot of pressure head.
It's like the biggest water tower you've ever seen. So anyway, that was something that I was thinking of, talking about this underground city.
So what would lawns look like there?
Ooh.
Maybe well, they have water lawns where they, like, you go out with your little scuba gear and you can walk your shark.
Well, in the Great Lakes, I don't think it'd be a shark, but
you can walk your bass.
Yes, you go bass walking. Swim your bass.
Yes, swim your bass. I'm gonna go.
You swim your bass back home. You could also have, like, suppose your residence was on the outside of this dome. You could actually have like a little seaweed, kelp, whatever, garden outside the dome, right? So it's like you can see it from your window, but you've got to go out of the dome to get to it, kind of thing.
Yeah. Little plot, like a little, almost kind of like a little garden designated for you, because it wouldn't really be around your residence, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, it'd be like your residence would include, say, 30 feet of lake bed out from the wall of the dome or something, you know.
Oh, okay. I feel you.
And then if you wanted, you could pay more and get a private airlock there, so you could go out directly to it. You wouldn't have to go out from like the city gate or whatever.
Sort of going on a bit of a tangent away from the lawn stuff. So let's take the city underwater. Had you ever thought of like a fail-safe system for like, what if the dome collapses or starts leaking a bunch of water? Because I would imagine all those people would be doomed otherwise.
Nope, not really. The practicalities were less exciting than just imagining an underwater city. But yes, I would imagine to get people to commit to live there, you'd have to offer them some assurances that they're not just going to die if your dome starts leaking, right?
Yikes.
It's like you hand everybody a life jacket when they buy a share in your private city.
I don't think
you might need this. Yeah, well, like I don't know.
The air city with the dirigibles, you know, if one of them pops.
I think that you could just segment enough, right, that it wouldn't be a worry if any one of them gets disrupted.
Or you do like a bunch of smaller ones instead of like a few right. big ones. So if you kind of have redundancy there, like a lot of them would have to go out at the same time.
And you'd probably want them like fixed in relation to each other with some sort of a framework, but they could all still be independent cells that are connected.
Yeah. I think that's how airships worked. Like, it's not like the big balloon was just, you know, it's not like it was just a big balloon. It had a bunch of, like, kind of bladders in it, if I remember right. Like, if you look at the anatomy of a hot air balloon, or not a hot air balloon, like a Zeppelin, it's not what you'd expect.
They're making a comeback, too, believe it or not.
Really?
Yep. I've read a handful of articles about companies that are investigating them for long distance cargo hauling, and some that are also want to do it as a form of tourism, like cruise ships in the sky, basically.
Oh, that'd be cool.
But I think that would be for like the ultra wealthy, essentially. Because a cabin is, I don't know, say it's like 10 grand or something.
Whew.
To go across the Atlantic or whatever.
Yikes. But maybe they're just trying to, you know, maybe it'll get cheaper as the industry right. develops.
Yeah. I think it'd be pretty sweet. I would ride in one. I think it'd be fun.
Now I'm curious on what they would do to keep it afloat, because helium is not easy to come by. Apparently the only source of helium on Earth, if I'm remembering right, is that is radioactive decay from just radioactive materials in the Earth's crust. So you actually, I think you end up finding, like, any helium that's harvested on Earth is found underground. And eventually the helium gas just leaches through the ground and then just goes up into the atmosphere, and then it's lighter than air, so it will float all the way up to the top of the atmosphere, then just get whisked away into space. So there's not a lot of helium on Earth. And I don't think there's an easy way of getting it. Now, if we come up with fusion reactors, we'll probably end up with a lot of spare helium. Well, actually not a lot, but...
Some.
Yeah, some. That'd be another source. And of course, you know, they used to... What is abundant is hydrogen. I think that's pretty easy to come by. But the Hindenburg taught us the dangers of that particular design choice.
Yeah, that's where you just make the balloon out of asbestos.
Yeah, there you go.
Solve that problem.
Is that airship full of hydrogen? Don't worry, it's covered in asbestos. Oh, now I feel safe.
Makes you feel so much better. Yeah.
What?
The Earth's atmosphere is what, like 80% nitrogen? Is that right?
I think it's...
Or is it argon?
I think it's 75... No, it's nitrogen. But I think it's 70 to 80. I thought it was 75 or so. Earth's...
Yeah, I was rounding it. I was going to say like 78%. 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen.
Oh, yeah, 78%. And then 20... Yeah. Oh, and argon is the next biggest constituent at about 0.9%.
Yeah,
helium.
So
helium is 0.000524%. So is that 5 in a million? 5 parts per million, something like that.
So you're telling 50? Me there's a chance. Well, so the sad thing about that is because there's so much nitrogen, we only have a couple of options of gases that are functional. Right.
Oh, because it's limited by how dense nitrogen is.
Right.
Yeah.
Sadly.
So conversely, so nitrogen, let's see, nitrogen gas. I want to see how heavy this is or how dense it is. N2, let's see. Dihydrogen or dinitrogen. Let's see. What happens if I just type density? Yes. Okay. Oh, it's only in metric. 1.25 grams per liter. Okay. Now, remember that figure. So now if I go to carbon dioxide, I look this up. Density. Oh my gosh, it's not even the same units. This is in kilograms per cubic meter. Oh, so many words that are gross in my mouth. Okay, hold on. Now I got to look this up. Kilograms per cubic meter to grams per liter. Oh, just one. See? Do you see how lame the metric system is? They have two units, or they have two like systems that mean the exact same thing. Now tell me that is easy, folks. So actually, wait, this can't be right. Oh, that's when it's solid. It's 1500 kilograms per cubic meter. Okay. When it's a gas, it's 1.97. So, carbon dioxide is about
35-40%
actually
more
is
dense.
This is going to be the easier way of putting it. It's 8/5 as dense as nitrogen dioxide. Dinitrogen. So carbon dioxide, and I say that because Venus's atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide, I believe. So it would be easier. You could basically just take a bunch of Earth's atmosphere, put it into a balloon, ship it over to Venus. Voila, you have an airship.
Yes. That's what we should do.
Now,
we definitely shouldn't bottle it into tanks so that it's more dense and then ship it and re-expand it there.
No, don't do that. Now, you will have to make your airship a little resilient against the sulfuric acid rain that Venus gets. But hey, once you get past that obstacle.
The density might be low enough that you float above the sulfuric acid rain. That could be happening beneath you.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Changing directions again. So we talked about lawns. We talked about how cities might be constructed. One of the other thoughts that crossed my mind is what other norms of our world would be different, a different part of the human experience if you were to live in a colony on the moon or on Mars. And what came to mind was athletic events, right? So take the Olympics, for example. Mm-hmm. We have all these athletes that are capable of astounding feats on Earth, but if you were to do high jump on the moon, for example, their record would be like 35 or 40 feet, right? Because of how much lower gravity is.
Yeah, it's a good point.
So when we use the term here as world record, it usually means no one else in the world has achieved a higher mark. But what that term would come to mean, I think, is eventually I'm assuming that there would be some of these types of things would be repeated on other planets. And then a world record would mean, instead of like no one's ever done it better, it would mean no one's ever done it better on that planet because the conditions are different in other places where it's been done. Yeah. So you could have an Earth world record for high jump, and then you could have a Mars world record for high jump, right? And then you'd have to have new standards like a solar system record or something like that, which would all be owned by the low gravity planets.
The term world record would have to have a more literal meaning.
Right. Yeah. Or maybe you have like a human species record or something, or I don't know. But that was another thing that came to mind is just imagining, you know, maybe more people would go rock climbing on the moon or on Mars, right? Because there's less risk of injury if you fall.
Well, yes, but I was going to say with the moon, at least if you're not in a biodome, there is no terminal velocity. So you couldn't You couldn't go skydiving. That parachute ain't going to do you any good.
Well, you could use different mechanisms, though. You could develop giant zorbs that you jump in, or like a massive bungee harness that's mounted inside of a frame.
What's a zorb?
A zorb is like bubble soccer.
Oh my gosh, where they wear like the big bubble, like they're running around in a ball.
Yeah, basically. But they make bigger versions of those that are like 3 meters in diameter.
Oh, wow.
Where you can actually fully climb inside, and they fill them with like soap and water. Not fill them, but like enough to reduce the coefficient of friction. And then you can just like slide in it down a hill, and the ball's rolling around you, and you're just basically experiencing this water slide all the way down the hill.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty neat.
I don't have my sound going right now.
That's good. But so I did the math a few years ago, and I found that if you were inside of a bubble soccer ball and you put that inside of a Zorb, you would only have like 60% of the surface area and available cushion needed to survive an impact at terminal velocity, even with the larger diameter object.
Ah.
So you'd have to go fairly large.
And if on your if you're doing that on Earth, your terminal velocity is going to go way down.
Right. The larger it gets, the lower your terminal velocity. And the more cushion you have.
Yep. And the softer of the blow. So I bet the... It's probably really sensitive to how big of this Zorb ball you're in to what your survivability is. Like, it probably isn't a very big difference between you're going to be soup inside of the ball by the time you're done landing to you're perfectly fine. Like, the difference between those two ball sizes is probably not going to be as big as a difference as you would think.
Yeah, that's probably true. And I think if you were in an airless environment, the ball would have to be so big, right? Because it's fully reliant on the cushion effect instead of on a terminal velocity reduction.
And the you get into a spacecraft, you just jump, so you're hurtling towards the moon, and then you turn on your jetpack.
I thought you were going to say then that the spacecraft swoops down and matches your speed, picking you up and then changing its direction.
That would be cool, too.
Have you seen the video? Red Bull actually did that with some guys in wingsuits where they jumped out of a little prop plane and the plane goes into like a nosedive. And then they end up flying back into the open side door of the plane later on.
I did see that. That was nuts.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
That is absolutely, yeah, it's insane, man. Because if the guy was just going a little too fast, or that plane was going a little too slow, I ran into the propeller.
Yeah,
I overshot as I was trying to get close to the plane anyway, went a little bit too past the door, and yikes.
The person having the wingsuit has control over their speed and pitch and direction as well, so they could correct if the pilot was off some. The bigger challenge, I think, is more so number one, the plane getting down fast enough that you're catching up to it instead of just blasting by it. And then number two is just because airflow is going to be much less stable around the plane, you'd have to account for any of those airflow disruptions.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I bet. I wonder how turbulent it was for those guys as they were approaching. Because that'd make control a lot harder.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure all the slipstream of the plane is going to have some turbulent effects around all the control surfaces. And then depending on how close they were, I think that's part of the reason they kind of like, once they were within like 4 feet or something, they just like dove through the door, basically, I think, was to try to avoid that super turbulent area really close to the plane surface.
Right. And then you turn your jet back on.
Yeah.
You're in the plane. All right, you're like, safe. Flame on.
So that actually makes me think of when you are skydiving. Obviously everyone has a parachute on, and typically, especially on hot days, you'll have the door of the airplane open so that you can get some cooling as you're climbing altitude. And there are instances that have happened where someone had their pilot chute was not properly stowed in their rig.
Oh boy.
And so it was like outside of their container. And then if you're sitting near the door, if there's enough of an air current, it can actually grab the pilot chute and pull it out the door.
Yikes.
And so you have to learn the protocol, because there are safety protocols for it. Basically, like if someone's drogue or pilot chute goes out the door, it's like you just kick them out. Because if you don't, it's going to get caught in the plane. It's going to, like, their parachute mess is going to bring the whole plane down, essentially, and to their detriment, right? They're going to get dragged along behind or something worse. So it's just kind of crazy to think about that, of like, if you see it, just get them the heck out of the plane. Like, unless it's within reach that you can grab it and prevent it from going out and expanding. Otherwise, you just get out as fast as you can. Yeah, or if you notice your own, yeah, you throw yourself out.
And if you, it's not like you're kicking these people out to their deaths, right? Because their chute is already in the process of getting deployed.
It's in the process of opening. Yeah.
I imagine that they just get kicked out and they just float their way down. And they're like, well, that sucks. I kind of got gypped out of a skydiving ride. But otherwise, they're going to be fine.
Yeah, I think assuming that you get out early enough that their main chute hasn't begun deploying and getting caught on the steering or elevator surfaces of the tail.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so I'm making the assumption that they get kicked out.
They get clear.
Yeah, but they get clear and their chute opens fine, which I would assume, again, unless it gets caught on either the frame of the door, like on the some pokey thing that catches the parachute as they're jumping, or if it gets caught on the elevator or the tail, that it would probably open just fine. Because I remember you were telling me once that nowadays parachutes are designed to where you can almost not pack them wrong. It's like they're designed to open no matter how chaotically or improperly you pack them. So I interpret that as meaning like they can kind of open somewhat haphazardly too, and they'll still be fine.
Yeah, you won't like how it feels when it opens that way, but it'll open. I mean, they're
jerky, right? It'll just be like a sudden yank rather than a soft.
Right. It's much less a question of will your parachute open in most cases. It's more a question of how comfortable will the opening be. So a better pack quality leads to a softer opening, less of a jerk.
Right. I had another question about that process, but I can't remember what it is. Did you ever
parachute opening?
Yeah. I can't remember. Well, I guess I can ask this. Did you ever 300 somebody through the door?
No. You mean kick them in the chest?
Yeah.
No. Dang. No, but so there is this like culture within skydiving of people are perpetually, there's like little fads and trends in like doing group dives when you leave the plane. So you can do different formations of all different standard varieties. And there's like a kind of like, what's the term for nautical flag signaling?
I don't know.
Semaphores, I think. Is that the right term? Now I got to look something up.
I do remember.
Yes. Method of visual signaling.
I do really, really quick remember my question about the parachute opening when you get kicked out.
Oh, sure.
Is the reason why, because I know like when you go skydiving, you want to wait for the right time to open your chute. Is that just so that you get as much of the free fall as possible? Like, is it safe to just open your chute shortly after you jump out of the plane? Or is there a danger of opening it too soon?
The primary danger of opening too soon is not about your proximity to the plane. I mean, that is if you're inside the plane. Once you're outside the plane, I would say you're separating rapidly enough. There's not really such a thing as too soon in relation to the space between you and the airplane. The primary reason you wait at all when you leave the airplane is because you want to make sure that your body position is stable and that you're oriented basically stomach to ground when you deploy your parachute. Because if you're not, if you're at all kind of cockeyed in the air, there's the potential that your parachute will deploy in such a way that all the lines that connect your parachute to your harness will get wrapped around your foot or your head or around the parachute or whatever. So most of the time you would, like at a minimum, you would count to three probably and make sure that you're stabilized in your body position when you deploy your parachute. That'd be the primary thing. But other than that, it's purely preference. So there are actually disciplines of skydiving where they'll jump out and immediately deploy their parachutes, and then they fly parachute formations the whole way down. Right.
Oh.
The other bookend, I guess I would say, is how much time you want to have in an emergency situation if something goes wrong with your primary chute to be able to react to it and potentially deploy your reserve with enough space before piling into the ground.
Okay.
So, yeah, typically that minimum threshold would be like 2,000 feet. But most people, like, that's an extreme end of it, right? Most people are going to be wanting to deploy significantly above that.
Okay.
Just so you've got some margin to work with if something goes wrong.
That's interesting. World War II dive bombers would normally start their dive at like 1,500 feet, if I remember right.
Oh, really?
Or at least the Stukas did. So, like, you know, 1,500 feet is like getting too close to the ground. That's at their, you know, these planes that are designed to dive onto a target. That's when they would, that's their highest point. That was pretty interesting.
That's pretty neat.
That's pretty neat. Is another reason why you don't want to pull your chute too early? Well, from what I'm gathering from you, there is no too early as long as you're physically ready to pull the chute. It's not like, don't pull your chute before 10,000 feet or X, Y, and Z is going to happen.
Correct. Yeah, the only other consideration in terms of earliness would be if for some reason there's a particular amount of turbulence coming immediately off of the plane, right? So even if you are stable, if you can feel that there's a significant amount of wind shear or some kind of weird currents going on around you, you may want to wait until the airflow stabilizes, even if your body is stable.
But that's not even a function of, you know, being too
it's
high.
It's not a function of altitude. No,
that's
right.
Just, yeah. How recently have you jumped out of the plane? Now, what about like if you pull it too early? So you pull the chute really high up in the air. Are you at a considerable risk of getting blown off target to a point where you can't, it's like, okay, I guess this is my life now. I'll see you guys 60 miles down the road.
It could be. And it can be a defect or a feature depending on what you need. Right. So there are branches of the military that would use that technique called HAO, high altitude, high opening, right? So they would actually jump out of a plane, deploy their parachute very high while they are in friendly airspace, right? So say you, I don't know what the range is. I want to say it's quite a ways. We'll say 10 miles or more. But you would be on your side of the border. You jump out at a very high altitude, deploy your parachute, and then you would parachute across the border, miles and miles covered, right? And then you'd land in wherever your clandestine mission is supposed to take place. But that way you are still officially legal, I guess, or compliant with that country's sovereignty when you jumped out of the plane. And then it's a lot harder to track something smaller like a parachute that's less rigid and has a smaller radar profile, and so you can kind of sneak across that way. But yeah, for a recreational diver, everybody wants to make it back to the drop zone where you started. And so one of the first things that you learn during ground school, I guess if you want to call it that, is how to read the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA's weather readings for the day. So there are weather stations all across the U.S. that report what their current wind conditions are from ground level up to, I don't remember what it is, 60,000 feet or something. And you have to be able to read those to understand which direction the wind is blowing at each altitude. Because in a worst case scenario, you might have, you know, surface winds that are blowing in one direction, and then one in the mid range, say at 5,000 feet, that's blowing perpendicular to that. And then at 12 or 13,000 feet, where you get out of the plane, they're going at 180 degrees from where they are at the surface. That's not out of the question. And so you have to know with some idea how strong the winds are. And so it might be a day where it's calm on the surface, but you get up a couple thousand feet and the winds are blowing everywhere. And so if you jump into that, or if you open your parachute into that, you're going to be blown significantly off course. So you might not jump, not because the ground conditions are bad, but because they're bad, so bad higher up that you're not confident you can land where you started. So the whole exercise of it's a partnership between the pilot and the people who are jumping. So typically the person who's by the door is called the spotter, and that's just assigned to whoever's closest to the door. So the pilot takes a jump run, which is where they're at the altitude they want to be at, headed in the direction that works with the wind, because you want to be upwind of your drop zone. So when they start on jump run, they basically give a green light by the door. There's actually a little light that'll illuminate. And this, again, this is in a larger drop zone with a larger airplane, so it's not like the pilot can just tap you on the shoulder or something. But then if the door is not already open, the spotter or somebody next to them would help open the door. And then that person looks and checks, are we actually where we think we are relative to the drop zone? Right? Because the last thing you want is to just jump out and then discover, like, oh, for some reason, the pilot, we're not over the drop zone. We're just jumping into fields or something. But anyway, so the spotter is supposed to make sure the drop zone is there. And then, you space your departures from the plane so that everybody has room to do their maneuvers in the air and safely deploy their parachutes, but then still get back and not be blown off course by whatever the prevailing winds are at the various altitudes. Sorry, that was kind of a long-winded response.
Yeah, but it's a good, like, that's good. And for, it's one of those things where you don't really realize how complicated it is. And I guess it makes sense jumping out of an airplane. You want to make sure all of your ducks are in a row. All your T's are dotted and I's are crossed and whatnot.
But and there's,
if you never go, you just never really think about these things.
Well, and even if you go on a tandem, you're not exposed to that degree of detail, right? You're just along for the ride. Somebody else manages all that information for you, so you don't have to worry about it. But yeah, when you learn and get licensed for skydiving, you have to learn all that material. It's in a some way, it's like a pilot light kind of. You got to learn. You learn how traffic is controlled a little bit around airports, what the different some of the different operating altitudes are from the FAA and what some of the laws are regarding skydiving, that kind of thing. And then you even got to be able to, as you're flying your parachute in, you're essentially the pilot of an aircraft at that point, and you've got to be able to avoid collisions with the other canopy pilots in the area. You got to be able to do a landing pattern that complies with standard procedures so that you don't cause an accident, right? Mm. And that includes reading if there's a wind sock on the ground or a wind triangle. You got to be able to see, like, if there wasn't, usually when you're on the ground, the whole plane will agree on a landing direction based on the prevailing winds, because you want to land going into the wind.
Okay. Makes sense.
And so, like, the drop zone where I learned, everyone flies a left-handed pattern. So that means you fly three legs. And so your first leg would be downwind, then your second leg would be a crosswind, and then your final leg would be into the headwind. And so you've got to set up your pattern. You're kind of like imagining this L-shaped or J-shaped approach where your destination is the place you want to land. And then you've got to back up based on how fast the wind is blowing, how quickly you're moving across the ground below you. You've got to judge when to make each turn at which altitude. Well, I mean, the altitudes are fixed, but you got to judge where to make those turns relative to the geographic features below you to try to hit the target where you actually want to land. But having said all that, usually everybody on the plane will agree on the landing direction so that you're all flying patterns that are aligned with one another and not crossing each other or headed the opposite direction, right? So you don't end up with T-boning someone or getting into a head-on collision.
Right. Well, do people normally land kind of jumbled all at once, or is it more like one person will jump, then like 30 seconds or a minute later somebody else will jump and you just keep going till everybody's out? And then I would assume based on that, they would more, oh, you know what? So I bet they could do that, or they could jump more or less all at once. But then because people are going to be pulling their chutes at different times based on their preferences, how they or when they land is going to be more or less random and unrelated to when they jump. Is that accurate?
Elements of it are. So there's two ways that you can. The goal is to create as much space as possible between groups and between individuals within that group to safely deploy your parachute and to have room when you're coming into land that you're not all landing at exactly the same time. So the two ways that you do that are by organizing the plane such that typically it's the people who are either going to, well, I'll say it this way. You can choose an order, but you want it to be sequential. So for example, the people who are going to open their parachutes at the lowest altitude are typically closest to the door. And the people who are going to open their parachutes at the highest altitude are farthest from the door. So that means the people who are closest to the door are going to be falling at terminal velocity for the longest period of time. They're going to get to the ground faster. So by letting them go first, you're creating more separation from the people who are going to open their parachutes later.
Right. A bigger gap between the first.
A bigger and gap. Right. Yep. And you can also do that with, so people who are wingsuiting, you would want to put either first or last in the load as well, because they're going to travel the most horizontal distance. So if you put them out first, they are going to create more separation from the group that goes after them. Or if you put them out last, they would have to make sure to do the same, right? But going away from the groups that just jumped, right? So there's a lot of ways you could work that, but you're essentially trying to, based on the types of groups, individuals, what type of skydiving they're doing, this is all being coordinated to maximize the amount of space between everybody on the plane after you get out. So that's both exiting the plane, you want space, and when you open your parachute and when you land. So that gives you the most opportunity. The other way, beyond just organizing who's on the load, the other way to create that space is when the plane is on jump run, based on the ground speed of the plane, you will determine a separation time between groups leaving the plane. So for example, the plane may have, say, like 130 knot airspeed, but there's a 30 knot headwind, so it only has 100 knot ground speed. And then the pilot will typically tell you what your separation time should be between groups, because like the drop zone I went to, they tried to make sure that there was, I think it was a quarter mile separation between groups. Maybe it's not that much, but it was a substantial amount. And so typically that meant if there was no headwind or even a tailwind, the minimum separation time would be like 4 or 5 seconds. If you had a headwind and you had a slower ground speed, you would be, you could be 8 or 9, 10 seconds between groups in some cases. But that's the other way that you create that separation.
What do you mean by groups? Are there like 3 or 4 people jumping out of the plane at the same time, or like in quick succession? It's not like 1 a few seconds later, 2 a few seconds later, 3.
They can range. So a group could be anywhere from 2 up to, like, the world record groups will jump from multiple airplanes and they'll have hundreds of people in them. But typically, especially if you're jumping from one plane, a group would be anywhere from, I'd say 4 is probably the most common, but anywhere in their like 2 to 8 range would be a not unheard of size of group on any given day.
Do they jump holding hands? Or what do you mean by, like, or they just
saying, yeah.
That's what I'm so confused about, what you mean by a group.
You can do it multiple ways. So there, sometimes everybody just like rushes out the door as fast as they can, and then you find each other in the air, right? But typically that means you have to spend precious moments of free fall trying to orient yourself to where everybody else in your group is, find them, and then link up. So that's, when people do that, it's typically only just for fun, or if you've got so many people that you can't build the formation. So like world record attempts, it's basically everybody piles out of the plane as fast as they can, and they jump from like 17 or 18,000 feet. So they have more time anyway.
Hot dog.
But then it's like, they're all just getting to the group as fast as they can. For smaller groups, what's more common is that you would actually jump from the airplane locked to each other. So each suit, like jumpsuit that you would wear, has grippers on it if you're doing formations, right? So it's actually like a foam or fabric pad, kind of like, imagine a thin, really thin pool noodle that's like sewn along the arms and the legs of the suit. And so you would actually grab onto those grippers of the other people in your group in varying formations, right? So I might have a hold of your, the gripper on your upper arm and the calf gripper on somebody else's leg, right? And then we go out and we're actually holding on to each other as the four of us leave the plane, and we have some formation that we're doing. And then once we're out of the plane, we start to rearrange ourselves into whatever the progression of the formation is going to be.
And just holding on to each other is just to prevent you guys from drifting too far apart right after jumping out?
Right. It's maintaining both distance and levels, right? Because if we're holding on to each other, we can't get separated vertically as much as you could if you're, if you let go.
Right. So that brings up a question that popped up in my head 5 or 10 minutes ago, which is, I imagine when you're doing a tandem jump, because you only ever see pictures of people doing tandem jumps. And this is just a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question. Like, you only ever see pictures of them when they're in the air. Is it really awkward when they're on the plane, just, you know, butt to crotch, you know, back to stomach, just waiting for the plane, and it's like, hey, how you doing? Is that a carabiner in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
No, I mean, I think it's, you kind of get over that a little bit. Like, that's the last thing on your mind, I guess, is what I would say. And it's just the natural, it's how it has to work with our current technology. So it's kind of just like you get over it, I would say. But yeah, there certainly is, like, that whole plane is loaded. Everyone's just sitting on the floor stacked up. So my parachute is in the groin of the person behind me, right? And their parachute is in mine. Oh, but yeah, okay. Everybody's in the same situation. So you're kind of trying to just accommodate and make room, make it as comfortable as possible for everybody. It's a little bit different for the tandems because they don't have a parachute between them and the person behind them.
Yeah, I was right? going to ask if they still give that person a parachute, just as like a, if the worst happens and somehow they get separated, do they still give that the person being tandemed, you know, a chute just in case? But it sounds like no,
because they couldn't wear it because they're harnessed directly to their instructor. And if they could wear it, they wouldn't know how to use it. And yeah, really their best hope is that nothing malfunctions with the harness and that their instructor knows what to do, right? That's why instructors have to be thoroughly trained and vetted to be able to even become one. You got to have over 500 jumps and do special certification.
Does anybody want to be the instructor doing a tandem jump? Or is that just like, I have to do it for this certain certification? Because I can't imagine that's a very pleasant experience. Although maybe it is, because you're, you know, somebody's first time and you want to just be there to comfort them and show them the ropes.
Yeah, I think it's like...
Or you like getting in people's personal spaces a little too much.
No, I think it's, if you want to get paid to skydive, that's a way to do it. And it also is... Yeah, it's a bucket list item for a lot of people. So you get to be kind of their tour guide to adventure, right? And you give them a briefing on the ground beforehand. You talk to them, you know, in the plane and afterward. So it's kind of, they're almost like a host more than they are just, you know, the person operating the parachute. So I think, yeah, there are a lot of people who enjoy it. And it's a way to make a living while skydiving as well. Because all those tandem skydives count for them too, right? So if they're trying to progress or to gain experience or whatever, they get to count tandem skydives the same as they would individual ones.
How much does a tandem instructor get paid usually? Like, what's a good ballpark estimate?
That is a good question. I don't know. It's not a ton, right? Like, at the drop zone where I went, a lot of the instructors lived on site, and they had like summer trailers, like either a mobile home or an actual like camper trailer that they lived in. But it was enough that they could pay their bills. And a lot of them would, in the winter, they'd go somewhere else and either be an instructor in Florida over the winter, or they'd have a part-time job in the winter that they'd work and then come back and be an instructor in the summer.
And I suppose you get a lot of jumps again, like that you're not, are just not paying. It's not that you just are getting them for free. You're actually getting paid to do them.
Right. Yep.
How many jumps a day can some of these guys do? Is it like one or two, or is it like they're just going up and down, like 10 times a day?
Yeah, you could, depending on how many or how much gear is available and how fast the planes are going up, you could be up and down in 30 minutes. But you have some briefing to do before and some other stuff afterward. So you couldn't do one every half an hour, but yeah, you could be close to it.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I've heard as many as like maybe 12 or 15 in a day as a ballpark. Maybe it's more. I'm not 100% sure, but it's a good number.
How long is it? Is the plane ride up versus the fall down?
So it all depends on what plane you have, how many people are on it, how big those people are, right? Because it's well, seriously, I mean, the planes are much more sensitive to the weight of the people on board than, say, an airliner is, right? Because sure. Just because of the relative size. But so one thing I learned, for example, is that basically pilots are, when people are leaving the airplane, so one of the rules is that you don't go to the door until you are the group jumping out. So basically everybody stays in their seat until it's their turn to jump out so that there's not a dramatic weight shift in the airplane.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And what I've found, or what I was told, is that the pilots are actually, as groups, individuals or groups are exiting the airplane, they're like making or preemptively making course corrections and adjustments to their ailerons and elevators and everything to keep flying straight and level, because the weight distribution is changing, the drag is changing, right? There's people hanging out the side of the airplane on one side. So they, like, as people are leaving the airplane, is one of the trickiest times for a pilot to actually keep everything straight and level as yeah. they're flying.
I was, so a little background for, I'm guessing maybe you know this, but also for the listeners, planes, you know, they have their control surfaces, like the ailerons, which control how the plane rolls. They have the rudder, which controls left to right, and the elevators, which will pitch it up and down, like those big flappy movie things on the edges of the wings or on the tail fins. But those control surfaces have a little itty bitty, like it's a flap on a flap, and they're called trim flaps. And those will help, like the pilots will set those to account for any imbalances in the plane. Like if one side of the plane is loaded more than the other, well, if all your control surfaces are neutral, your plane's going to start rolling. So that's what but that weight distribution isn't really going to change a whole lot over flight. So you set your trim once and then it's good. Same thing if your weight is a little heavier in the back or the front than it usually is, then you would set the trim on the elevator to kind of give you a little bit of bias. So this little flap is either always trying to put you a little nose down if you're heavier in the back, or a little nose up if you're heavy in the front. Same thing with the rudder. It can kind of bias you left or right if there's something else about the plane that's already biasing you. It's meant to counteract these biases. So I remember, normally you'd set them once at the beginning, and you may have to do some adjustments mid-flight, like if certain fuel cells in the plane are getting depleted, that's going to redistribute the weight, and they're going to have to redo the trim over time. Or like if you're in a military aircraft and you drop your ordnance, you might have to reset trim then. But I remember there was some plane carrying, I think it was a football team, like a college football team or something, and the pilot noticed for a while in his flight, he kept having to readjust his elevator trim. So like he would set the trim, and then all of a sudden, hey, we're starting, like our rudder or our elevator is in neutral position, but now we're starting to go a little nose up. Okay, I'll adjust the trim. Then a few minutes, you know, a little bit later, okay, now we're starting to go nose down. Let me adjust the trim back. Okay, we're going nose up again. Let me, like, what's going on? And he went out, he checked the cabin or the passenger compartment, and turns out that the footballers were running back and forth in the plane.
Yeah.
So the weight distribution kept shifting closer to the nose, closer to the tail, closer to the nose, closer to the tail. And that's going to make the plane wobble, you know, pointing up and pointing down, pointing up. So you kept having to adjust the trim. Because of that, he probably went back there and said, "Hey, stop it, you dumb kid.
Stop that, stop that."
So yeah, that's what trim is. And if you ever look at a schematic of like a plane, and you look at the control surfaces, you'll usually notice one of the two. So like, you know, the ailerons, one's on the left wing, one's on the right wing. You'll notice that one of them will usually have what looks like a little like rectangle or something on it that the other one doesn't. And that's the trim flap. Sometimes they'll have trim flaps on both, but a lot of times they'll only have them on one.
Going back to the pilots, like with ordnance making adjustments, if you think about it, a pilot for a skydiving aircraft is dropping ordnance, right? It's just organic ordnance.
Have you ever heard a pilot? You know, you're getting people start jumping out. You just hear the pilot, "Bombs away, bombs away."
I have not.
Oh, I want to.
It makes me think of Aladdin, though, right? With the genie, who's like, "Geronimo, Geronimo, Geronimo, Pocahontas."
Oh yeah, I think I vaguely remember that.
But speaking I don't think I answered your
question. When I was a kid, I went to Aladdin movie theaters, and I did the whole movie, or a lot of it, was just run up and down the aisles.
Oh, you were that kid, huh?
Yep. I was like two or three or something.
Yeah.
And I think it was because the movie theater was empty, my mom or dad let me do it. I was obsessed with Aladdin as a kid. Anyway, sorry, please continue.
So the way you showed your obsession was by running around?
Not paying attention to it, yeah.
But answering your question, in terms of how long it takes, I think if you're on a light load, it could be as, in a larger plane, it could be as little as like 15 minutes, or if you're fully loaded air temperature makes a difference too, the density of the air. But so if you're fully loaded, you could potentially be 20 or 25 minutes, depending. And it also depends on how strong the winds are, like how far they have to go, because the plane's like spiraling upward essentially. And so if they have to travel a really long way because of the wind conditions to drop you off at the right point, that adds to the time as well.
They're spiraling up. I never knew that. I thought they just went, you know, so I think that question's popped up in my brain, because I assume that they just, you know, they got in the air, they just started climbing in a straight line. And then I was like, do you jump out then? And then you end up landing in a place far away from where you took off? Or do they turn, like they reach altitude, then turn around, and then as soon as they're back over the drop site, they drop you off? But I guess not.
No, and I think even in a lot of commercial flights, if you pay close attention, typically shortly after takeoff, you'll end up banking. So you'll take off in a direction that's favorable for the surface winds, and then you will bank and continue climbing, but you'll be banking to align with the direction of your primary flight path. So in a lot of instances, you don't take off in the same direction that you intend to fly.
I always thought that wasn't so much because of ground conditions, but just availability and the directions of the runways themselves. Because obviously, you know, run like even the big runways, they'll have like kind of looks like a triangle. So
what, yeah,
once one every, is it, I think it's 60 degrees, you'll have a direction, but obviously it's not going to align perfectly every time. So I thought that's why they were banking, but I guess it's more has to do with ground surface winds. Okay.
Yeah, typically, I mean, if you have a choice, and I'm not a pilot, but my understanding is the strong preference is to land, or is to take off into a headwind, similar to what you would want when landing, because it's easier to get the relative airspeed between the wing and the wind. So you can take off in a shorter distance, right? And you don't have to be going as fast on the ground. If you've got a tailwind, it's a lot harder. You got to be going faster. Crosswinds obviously add their own complexities. But so my understanding is that airports will typically route traffic to the optimal, and obviously it's not perfect in every situation, but the optimal runway for the wind conditions at the airport on that day. And then that's how everybody launches, right? And maybe they make adjustments eventually, but that's my understanding of how it works.
So any one plane or any one airport will primarily use just one runway at a time for all their planes, assuming that the traffic isn't so great that they have to switch different to different runways, but then they'll have like three different ones to choose from.
Yeah, what you'd see for like if you're like at O'Hare or any significantly large airport, you can actually see they'll have sets of those triangles, right? So you would have potentially three runways that are parallel to each other so that you can have that much traffic flow on in any given wind condition, right? Because there have been times where I've come into land in various airports and we were landing simultaneously to another plane on a runway, you know, a half a mile or a mile to the side of us.
Right.
It's hard to gauge the distance at an airport, but anyway.
Yeah, I'm looking at MSP's airport and yeah, they have like, they have this sort of triangular-ish shape to them. So like they're kind of all the runways are kind of in, they're either parallel to other runways or they're like 60 degrees angled. But yeah, there's like, it's not just, it's like a 3 to 4 runways all parallel with one another, make one strip. And then there's another strip at 60 degrees with another 4 runways.
And then, I mean, a lot of the ones where they're side by side like that, those would be taxiways, right? So for aircraft to get to and from the runway, but like, it looks like they've got, at least on the primary kind of east-west roughly runways, they've got 2 main runways that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably aligns with the primary wind direction in the area, right? You'd set up more runways in those directions and the other ones are just kind of for the rare occasion where you've got different winds.
Yeah. Cool stuff, man.
But I don't think, I mean, buttoning that up, I don't think on any given day there would be traffic landing on the cross runways, right? I think everybody in and out would be using the same directions.
Right.
Unless the wind shifted significantly.
So well, anyway, that's what lawns will be like in space.
I'm glad you brought it all the way back. Yes. Really making the connection for our listeners.
Everything comes full circle, Ben.
And full square.
I think that is a good place to end. We went a little over, didn't we?
We did. We got some bonus material this time, Will.
But it was good. Learning about,
I'm not upset about it.
Yeah. Hopefully our listeners won't be either.
So this does give me an idea. And if you're listening to this, feel free to reach out to us individually or on Facebook or comment on one of the streams. But I think this actually would be a good opportunity to maybe start a series of topics where it's like skills or hobbies that we have that we know a fair amount about that maybe are less common in the general public that we could just share a little brain dump of what we know about those different things. And as Jack kind of acted as an interviewer here with questions of curiosity about skydiving, we could just take turns doing that. So that was just something that occurred to me. We could maybe dive more into in the future.
If we're going with skills, I think the series on me would be dreadfully short. It could just be like little, you know, what's trivia, you know, or what's something that you're really into. Like I could probably talk a full hour on like just World War II planes and like the different designs and technologies that were developed.
If you want to hear an hour on World War II planes.
Yes.
Type a 1 in the chat.
Or type something else or nothing at all. We'll take them all as votes.
Yes. They're all votes. Yes. A vote is yes. A non-vote is yes. We're doing it.
If you say no, I'll take that as a maybe.
Wow.
But I take maybes as yeses, so.
Well, on that note, we've reached our stopping point, so thanks for hanging with us. Hope you enjoyed the additional time with Tangential Banter on this episode, and we will certainly catch you next time.
It was fun, Ben.
Take care.
Yep, thanks for all the info tonight. It was good.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Mm-hmm.